Listening to Icons and Icons, a Final Fantasy 14 King Club podcast. This is episode 64. Yeah, this is episode 64, covering our pursuit of Archbishop Thordon and our reuniting with Ystola. I'm your host, Chris Taylor. My pronouns are he, him, and with me is my esteemed co-host,
Ryan Beatty. My pronouns are they, them.
What happened last time?
Last episode, after they murked our buddy Horshafant, we chased Archbishop Thordon and his Heaven's Ward knights into the Sea of Clouds, where we rescued a tribe of Vanu Vanu from some Imperial soldiers, and then found out that the key to Azaz Law that Thordon is looking for has been eaten by Bismarck, the Sky Whale Primal. After we did our primal killing thing, Thordon showed up with a couple of Asians, stole the key from us, and flew away like a cowardly little worm. We begin this episode with a quest called A Difference of Opinion.
What made me laugh was you reading that made me realize that the time from Horshafant dying to you doing literal Moby Dick shit is the same time window and the same whiplash as Aeris getting murked and then you snowboarding down a mountain.
Yes.
Just for a different kind of guy, the guy who likes Moby Dick.
Doing Moby Dick shit to process our grief.
That's right. Alphanode is undeterred by a recent hoisting. Alphanode has never been deterred by any hoisting.
No, he was deterred by exactly one hoisting. He let that define his entire personality, and then a couple of people that he respected were like, "Oh, don't feel so hard. Don't be so hard on yourself. Don't feel so bad." And he was like, "Bet."
The Crystal Braves is Alphanode's Confederate flag. All I'm saying. Oh, people just love to be hanging their L's on the wall, and that's his. We succeeded in clearing up another primal and prevented the Vanu Vanu's lands from being consumed by a whale instead of all of the other people interested in colonizing their space.
Boof.
What we really did is preserve their land for them to take later. He asks us to join him in informing Chief Sanu of our victory. Here, it made me mad that they just teleport you there, which is what I want to happen, but it made me mad because I'm like, oh, they've done this before, so now It's really dumb. And all the other times where me and NPCs go to a place and then they make me teleport there instead of just moving me there.
Yeah, yeah. No, they're like showing off like, hey, we have the capability of doing this and we're still going to make you scoot from place to place. In the future, by the way.
If we did this, there would be 80% less content in Shadowbringers.
Mm-hmm.
When we get back to Ok-Zundu, Alphanode feels like something is wrong. We go sneaky and spy the entire village tied up and being menaced by Imperial troops. Regula Van Hydrus, a new-to-us Garlean commander, senses us. I don't call him a used Garlean commander. Rude. His heavy armor and horned helmet mark him as a capital M, major Imperial antagonist, and Alphanode seemed to recognize his name last episode. Regula demands we reveal ourselves. Having picked out really shitty hiding places behind a rock, we stand up and comply. Regula remarks that he was expecting more beastmen and asks us who we are. Before we can answer, the camera cuts off to a pair of fancy boots, and it's fucking Emperor Varus Zos Galvis. And he makes himself known to us with his fucking sick ass hair.
Yeah.
Regula kneels before him as he approaches us into old guy metal band hair, apparently.
Oh my God. No, yeah, that's extremely what it is. So yeah,
he's Saruman. That's what he looks like.
He looks like young Saruman. Absolutely. No, maybe not young Saruman from the new Amazon show, because I haven't seen that, but like, if you imagine,
is there an Amazon show called Young Saruman?
No, but there's
like a Young Pope
or Young Sheldon or Young Pope Sheldon. No, it's called The Rings of Power, and it takes place before Lord of the Rings.
No, he's not in that.
Okay. Well, just yeah, imagine Saruman as a tall, young, hot guy, and it's this guy. We only caught a glimpse of Emperor Varus in A Realm Reborn, like when it was basically all we saw was his crowning ceremony as his dad died, and he, as Chris mentioned, has extremely long blonde white hair that like is parted in the middle and cascades over his chest. And he's got a scar across his left eye and an enormous helmet in the image of a dragon. And, you know, like all of the like big Garlean Imperials have horns on their helmets, and his horns are actually dragon wings.
Also, they put the crown on top of it. They gave him a hat on a hat to prove he was the emperor. That rocks.
Yeah, it does. It rocks. This design is absolutely extra and ridiculous, but I love it. It works.
And you know what? You know what really sells it is the classic Imperial theme every time he's on there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's his own little personal theme song. Emperor Varys, when he meets us, says that he initially thought Ishgardians were responsible for the disappearance of the scouts that he sent ahead of him, but now he sees that it was us, the Warrior of Light. He tells us that Rawile, who, as a reminder, was Rauban's right-hand woman in the Immortal Flames, who turned out to be an Imperial mole named the Ivy, was right about us always showing up at the wrong time.
Game, you can't bring up something that stopped being relevant 50 hours ago. What are you fucking doing?
There's so much of that
here. Yeah. They just love to pretend like an Endwalker. They just love to pretend that this thing didn't happen 9 years ago. Shut the fuck up.
Uh-huh. Well, and like, especially at the pace that we're playing, it's like 50 hours and also like, you know, 20 episodes ago, essentially.
Yeah, but this is the real pace, right? Like, mm-hmm. of actual content release is basically the pace we're going through the game at. You can't be doing this.
Yeah. No, I put this little reminder in here because me, who is playing this game for the second time and taking notes on it and paying closer attention than folks have ever paid attention to Final Fantasy XIV. That's not true. There are lore sickos galore for this game. But I was like, wait, who was Rawile again? And so I had to go and look it up, and I was like, oh, but he was like, oh, yeah, Rawile was right. It's like, who the fuck are you talking about, my guy? What? Who is that even?
Yeah.
So Regula turns his head to look at us as he puts it together that we were the ones who defeated Gaius Van Belsar. The Emperor realizes that we are also after Azislaw. Though he thinks that we're after the power inside it and not trying to stop someone else from getting it. And finally, someone just lays out what it even is in there inside Azislaw. So somewhere inside this enormous Allegan structure exists their old secret of binding icons to their will. And Varys thinks we are aligned in our desire to wipe out the primals. We just disagree on the solution.
Alphanode is defiant. He replies that the Empire is always out here genociding left and right, and that is why the Scions will continue to oppose their attempts to eliminate the primals and just generally occupy territory. Mm. Varys is impressed at Alphanode for speaking his mind when every word could be his last. Fucking get his ass. That's Alphanode's whole deal. The Emperor counters that we are thinking too small. The fate of Eorzea and its inhabitants pale in comparison to the fate of the whole world. He does a little cape flourish and solemnly swears as Emperor to bring the icons to heal, even if that means the extermination of certain elements. God. Here's the problem with Final Fantasy XIV is that the fascists are so cool and so likable in Final Fantasy XIV. Big problem for me. A rule of cool guy.
And they're fascists on all sides there because Rauban, also cool and charismatic.
Pippin is a little fascist and we love him.
Yeah, we love Pippin, folks.
Seeming to take this as a command, the group of soldiers that Regula and Varys traveled with all salute and run towards the captured Vanu Vanu with their weapons drawn. Alphanode reaches out and yells at them to stop, that these Vanu are not Bismarck's thralls. We grimace, seemingly powerless to stop the massacre as the Zundu villagers prepare for their fate.
I thought our grimacing routine was dumb here. Like, we're the fucking warrior of light. We can probably murk all of these guys before they lay a single blade on a single feather of Vanu Vanu, but whatever. It's plot.
I hate to tell you, the reason why is that in cutscenes, we're not the warrior of light. Like, in a cutscene, Thancred and Yugiri could take care of this like they did with the fish people. But we could not take care of this. We could not stop them all because we're not Thancred or Yugiri in a cutscene.
So dumb. So dumb. We're the most powerful being in existence, but only when we're actually, like, in control of us.
Yeah, but we're like a 2020 who doesn't have trample, Ryan. We're going to get blocked by all these 1-1s.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. It's fucking little piss ants.
The least relatable analogy possible.
Suddenly, a cluster of fireballs sends the Garlean soldiers sprawling. Regula wonders where the blast even came from, and then we hear Lucia shouting for us to take cover. She soars over our heads, piloting a Magitek war machine that's painted all white everything that she just has, and the armor slams down in front of us. Regula sticks a protective arm in front of his emperor and recommends they withdraw.
This is Livia's Magitek, by the way.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's going to make a shit ton of sense in about 5 to 10 minutes. I forgot how much Lucia was a character in Heaven's Word. Like, I just thought that all of her screen time was next to Aimeric. And it turns out that she has, like, a whole ass arc and agency and takes action in the story. And it surprised me. I was like, I thought that I played this before and I don't remember Lucia at all. And it turns out she's cool.
Yeah, she's like a real B-tier NPC. Like, in the way that Graha is a B-tier NPC for most of the expansions.
Yeah.
Also, bummed out here, where's the big warship from Cloudtop? I understand it would take you a long time to make the model, but that's what should have been here.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And like, especially because that's been like Chekhov's airship. Like, you know, it's come up in the story how there's just this like massive airship that is parked in Cloudtop that can't fly. And it's a bummer that it's not here.
And it's really goofy that it's a Magitek because, like, I've done these. I know how big the AOE on that explosion is. Those Vanu Vanu are toast.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's no way they got spared, but...
It plays the wrong sound effect. Where's the laser charge up sound effect? This is a big bummer for me, actually, in terms of implementation.
Wow. I hadn't thought of that before, but sure.
Wow, uncool robot.
Genocide is bad. Wow, uncool robot. So the Emperor's massive warship flies into frame and mortars strike the ground in front of us, sending us into cover and covering the area in dust that Varus uses for his escape. He vows that we will meet again as he flies off in a little taxi ship that takes him back to his enormous airship. Alphanode wonders why the Emperor himself would lead the expedition to Azizlah. He's a bit shaken by our encounter with Varus. He tries to shake it off and worries about our friends back on the Enterprise. He says that he will meet us there once he finishes speaking to Chief Sonu.
When we talk to Lucia, she tells us that she had the armor sent here as a precautionary measure. But we try to talk to the villagers about their ordeal. They're all back to normal and only say the things they said before their brush with death, even the chief.
So this didn't really bother me at the time because it just like wasn't that kind of game to me. You know, it wasn't going to be a Trails game where every time a plot thing happens, the NPCs around the world have new shit to say. But in hindsight, like Biggs and Wedge have unique dialogue after this, like all of the NPCs that aren't kind of like permanently locked to the overworld can have unique dialogue. So like, why can't the tribes people? And like, I don't necessarily mean that in an explicitly intentional, like Square Enix is racist way here, but I kind of do because it ends up having an effect that like, they just don't care to render the tribes in that much detail. And I know that part of it might be technical because they hadn't figured out like overworld instancing until Shadowbringers, but it bummed me out going back to these villagers and like they just didn't have anything to say about the fact that they were almost just massacred. They just went back to their wind talk and, you know, talking about sky fishing and shit.
Are you interested in a technical explanation of how you would implement this if you can't transition an entire area?
Yeah.
Every NPC would need a series of flags to check plot progress and spit different dialogue. This would need to be implemented on NPC by NPC basis, which is why NPCs only update while the plot is happening in this zone. And then once you leave a zone and come back, they'll have the same dialogue forever because of how it's on an NPC by NPC basis and is inviable to do.
So that makes a ton of sense from a technical standpoint, but it sucks.
It does suck. It really tells you I'm never coming back here, actually.
Right, right. 100%. Yeah.
Cid thanks the 12 that were alive after he saw the battleship fire on the village. He asks us what happened, and his response to all of it is, first the Archbishop shows up with an Ascian in tow, and now the God's damned Emperor pays us a visit. What is this, a procession of notable bastards? And then Alfredo just does the side-eye bear meme. Who's next? The Keeper of the Seventh Bloody Gate.
Yeah, this is very good Cid characterization. Love this outburst. It is a little sus that the localization team is using bastard as like a PG-13 insult during a plotline that heavily features a literal bastard who has been judged and resented his whole life for his parentage. It's like when they bring up like sex exploitation and also use the word whore sons all the time. Just like very just. Take another pass at it. There are other words, y'all.
Yeah, come on. You can't say horse sons when horse sons is like a synonym for bastard. Come on.
Yeah.
Alphanode shows back up and informs the group that the Zundu were overjoyed that Bismarck was slain. Lucia follows close behind him and explains that the tribe was caught totally unaware and wisely offered no resistance, meaning that no Vanu Vanu was harmed during the making of this quest. If the Emperor was really intent on their extermination, the village would have been leveled. He's really only interested in reaching Azazla. Cid tells us that we're ready to resume the chase, and the quest reward is a wind-up Cid minion. I love how Cid is, like, personality-wise nailed down, and then every expansion is just him getting gravelier and gravelier as his, like, voice actor continues to smoke, like, 30 cigars a day.
Yes. So, Lucia stomps her Magitek armor onto the airship first. Cid informs us that Wedge has calculated a course to Azazla using the beam of light that the key emitted when it turned into a Xenosaga object last episode. Cid thinks that his ship is better than theirs, and so we'll be able to catch up to them. We take to the skies, and Lucia begins to muse on her past. She never thought she would pilot a suit like that ever again. She removes her, like, armor tiara and reveals a Garlean forehead jewel. Her full name ends up being Lucia Go Junius, and she was born a citizen of Garlemald. Cid chuckles as he realizes that he thought she looked familiar. He accidentally almost called her Livia, aka Livia Sas Junius, one of Gaius's faithful commanders. That turns out to be Lucia's sister. After their parents died in an uprising, the two of them were sent to live in different households.
While Livia trained to be a soldier, Lucia trained to become a spy. The two types of people you could be. Her mission was to investigate Ishgard's vault for elegant relics, but then she met Sir Aemerick. She believed he too was a prisoner of his past due to his heritage, but unlike her and Livia, he did not curse his fate. He simply rose above it. In time, she realized that she had a new home and a man worth following. She confessed to Aemerick and he accepted into her service. Alphadode, who is still rude even though he's maturing, expresses his concern about Lucia's loyalty to her sister. She has been gazing wistfully out at the sun during this trip down memory lane, and she turns around to smirk at Alphanode. She doesn't dwell in the past, and she fights for her convictions, just like her sister did.
Cid, for his part, is glad to have another Garlean in our crew, especially one who can make Magitek armor sing. He grins at Lucia. Biggs and Wedge announce that we're getting close. Azazla should be just through the clouds in front of us. Cid tells us all to hold on as he grips the steering wheel and hurls us towards the clouds.
I can't believe we got cucked out of being the robot guy, by the way.
What do you mean?
Like, we were the Magitek guy, and now we got replaced by Lucia. You kill one sentient robot named Maggie, and now no one wants you to be the robot guy anymore. That's fucked up. Everyone makes mistakes, Sid.
It was just an accident, Sid. We just drove her too hard, even though, like, she clearly had feelings and a strong sense of loyalty to us.
Please, give me your entire body so I can get through this door. It's made of splot concrete, you don't understand.
Rip to Maggie, but Lucia's different. On the other side, the sky is a sickly brown and green smog. A gargantuan elegant structure floats beneath us, black and crimson and alien and streaked with glowing neon. Sid is first to spot it, but before we can get close enough to land, we smack into an energy barrier and get buffeted back, unable to move forward. The hull of the Enterprise catches fire, and Wedge tells his chief that the ship won't hold. Biggs shouts that the artillery propeller is gone. Alphanode tells him it's no use and asks him to return us to Ishgard so we can find another way through. Sid curses the Allegans for making everything so complicated. He steers away from the barrier before the Enterprise breaks apart.
And everyone groans, remembering the process of getting into the Crystal Tower. We land safely in Ishgard. Wedge is marveling at Lucia's armor and wondering if she has a name. Biggs is getting a headache, thinking about all the repairs they're going to need to do, and Alphanode hopes he never has to fly with Sid again. Sid bemoans that they had just barely finished the repairs from the Bismarck mission, but is grateful we're all unharmed. Any landing you can walk away from and all that. The key must have been what let the Soleil pass through the barrier.
Alphanode convenes a meeting at Aemmerich's chambers so he can figure out how to get through the barrier without a key. Even Count Edmont shows up, apologizing to us for his outburst earlier, "It's fine, dog, your son just died," and telling us of his resolve to remain strong through his grief. Sid explains that the barrier is made of lightning ether, but is way more powerful than the ether barriers that we've been able to nullify before. The Enterprise would not even be able to carry the amount of crystals that we would need to generate an anti-barrier. That being said, Sid has some ideas. We might be able to pierce the barrier instead of nullifying it entirely. If we could build a ram made of condensed ether anyway, which unfortunately he has no clue how to build. Very like Silicon Valley. This is very Theranos to me. Like, we just need to create a blood test that only uses a micro droplet of blood. I don't know how to do it, but we're gonna make money anyway.
Yeah, he's just an ideas guy.
Mm-hmm.
Alphanode laments that the Archons still aren't with us, and everyone is confused because it's been 40 hours since anyone referred to one of the Scions as an Archon. Count Edmont pipes up to say he saw Tataru looking especially happy last night and rambling about how she had a lead on one of the Archons. This lifts Alphanode's spirits immediately. Sid tells us to go look for our friend while he repairs and reinforces the Enterprise.
He mugs at the camera here and says, "It will be an airship reborn," and I groaned out loud even though I live alone.
Inside the Forgotten Knight, we catch up with Tataru. She thinks this barrier business is typical and, brother, don't you fucking know it. But is eager to tell us about her good news.
After things began to return to normal in Ulda, Tataru asked Pippin to have the Royal Guard search the tunnels underneath the city. During our escape, that was the location where we lost touch with Ishtola, Minfilia, and Thancred. Pippin got a message to Tataru yesterday that there had been a discovery, but didn't say anything else about it. We head to the Hall of Flames to meet with him, and Tataru picks up Rion Jay along the way. Alphanod thanks Pippin for his assistance with this, and Pippin responds that it's the least he can do to repay us for saving both the Sultana and his dad, Rauban. Tataru is impatient and starts pleading with Pippin to just spill the beans about what the discovery is anyway.
During the tunnel search, his men came across a collapsed cave, underneath which he found the bodies of 12 crystal braves, but only traitorous ones. Amidst the bodies, they found Yashchola's wand, but Yashchola's body wasn't there. And this is when they hold it out, and it's very funny to look at. Yurianje flips down his aetherscope visor, and the fucking the Splinter Cell sound plays, and he asks for the wand. He detects that it was used to teleport Yashchola into the life stream itself. Before Alphanod can get too hopeful, Yurianje explains that the spell she used to do so was banned by Charlayan because it was too dangerous and unpredictable. Yashchola could be trapped inside the life stream, unable to phase out. No one cares about Thancred for, like, this entire thing, by the way.
For real? There's, come on.
Yeah. Oh, Yashchola, she might not be able to come back. It's been a really long time. And then we go do a bunch of other shit, leaving Thancred there. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
There is still hope, though. Her passage through the life stream might be traced. We all head out to the Sildid excavation site to see what we can find. At the stream near where we escaped during the assassination, Yurianje uses his visor again and then points northeast to the Twelveswood. I love that this is just the plot cave. They did not put any other ruins anywhere. So anytime you need ancient ruins, you're coming to this one cave. Like, We did it for Hildebrand. We've done it multiple times in the plot quest. You do it for Monk twice.
And then they bring it back and put a unique plot cave dungeon in there in Endwalker's Endgame.
Yeah, it's really silly to me. I love this.
Yeah. Also, it, like, just imagine having a bloodhound, like a tracking hound that speaks in ye old speech all the fucking time, because that's essentially what Yurianje is right now. He's just like sniffing the ether out and then pointing.
Up to sounds wild.
So while he points to the Twelveswood, while Yurianje is pointing the Twelveswood, Gridania has not reported any sightings of Yashchola, leading Alphanod to believe she is still adrift in the life stream. This worries Yurianje. If one stays too long inside the life stream, the aether that forms their soul will be scattered and dissolved by the torrential flow of the stream. Alphanod springs into action. He orders Yurianje to research reversing the spell, while he and Tataru will go with us to Gridania to ask the Seed Seer for help. The elementals are believed to be able to sense the life stream, and he wants to see if we can contact them through their chosen Padjal.
We go inside the Lotus Stand when Kani Senna is glad to see us. Alphanod apologizes for barging in like this. We didn't barge in. We talked to a guy who had to let us in after asking the other guy. Fuck off, Alphanod.
Also, we scheduled this. Like, we sent word ahead.
Yeah, what are you doing? But this is a matter of life and death. Kani Senna immediately understands the urgency. However, she warns us that the fundamental difference between man and elemental may cause some difficulty. Elementals do not perceive the world via senses or give names to the things they value. Instead, they perceive by observing the ebb and flow of life energies. While the seers can communicate through feelings, they will need to be presented with an ether that feels similar to Yashchola's, like a family member. This whole thing and everything that happens after makes me so fucking glad I never did the White Mage quest.
White Mage quest sucks.
Yeah. Especially when I get to see the two losers that you had to hang out with the whole time. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Yeah. And that kid with a stupid fucking bowl cut is the most racist, xenophobic little kid in the fucking world.
Look, I would rather be hanging out with my problematic gladiator friend.
Absolutely.
Tataru happens to know exactly who might fit the bill. Yashchola once told her about a sister who came to live with her in Gridania. Han E. Senna sees this as incredibly fortunate and asks us to find the sister and bring her to the Evershade.
It is extremely convenient that she has a sister.
Isn't this the Everglade?
No, it is Evershade. Everglade's the one in
Florida.
Is
it spelled that way? Evershade?
Yeah, it is. It is. It is. Everschadenfreude is
a, I hate that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. There's no reason for that C in there at all. There's just no reason for it. Alphanode had no idea that Ishtola had a sister, and after the string of setbacks and misfortune we've had recently, he does not trust such seeming serendipity. But there are no other options, really, so he's like, might as well go with it. Dotaru remembers that her name is Yemitra, and she should be a member of the Sons of Saint Koinok, who, as a reminder, are the Charlayan researchers of ancient relics that helped us in our interminable Crystal Tower quest. We go looking for her around Gridania's waterfall, an old haunting ground of hers. We don't have to go looking for long. She's standing right in front of the falls.
I disagree. I had three different class quests to turn in around Gridania, which made this episode very trying to use the map.
Oh, God. Well, I'm sorry for that. If you don't have any pending class quest to turn in, she's just right there. Alphanode introduces us to her, and we explain why we came looking for her. When Yemitra heard that the Scions were being pursued, she desperately tried to reach her sister, and now she understands why she had no luck. She's surprised that Ishtola would have been reckless enough to use a forbidden spell.
Bladed, why is this a shock to you?
Yeah, you, like, your sister is very reckless when it comes to magic, actually. She's like, yeah, whatever, I'll just, like, you know, cook up this world-destroying spell. No big deal. She would be glad to help us petition the elementals. They actually end up only being half-sisters. They share a dad, but not a mom. And before we leave for Evershade, she hopes that that will be close enough for the old ones to do their thing.
Shout outs to their dad, who has a type and just keeps getting it. Because they look identical.
They
have different mothers. So he just had, like, he's just got a single type and he goes for it every time. Respect.
Man knows what he wants.
Yeah, that's right. Beneath the massive tree in the Twelves Wood that we helped the Padjal calm in the White Mage quest line, we begin the elemental petition. Connie Senna closes her eyes and calls out to the life stream with the help of her two younger siblings. Their three staves glow brilliant white, and Tataru pleads in a quiet voice for Ishtola to come back to us. The air begins to twinkle beneath the tree. Connie Senna opens her eyes and says, "There," when a particularly bright pinpoint makes a chiming sound. The three Padjal lift their staves even higher, and the light expands, turning into a portal out of which Ishtola's naked and unconscious body floats gently to the ground, and Final Fantasy XIV graphic designers are sad that they really can't do their real magical girl shit, which is what they want to do here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then Yemitra runs forward to attend to her sister, and a guardswoman covers Ishtola in a blanket because they're like, oh, this is a T-rated game, and she can't just, like, glow in a brilliant light to hide her naked form for long.
Vanille was here.
We move towards her as well, and Connie Senna stops us, wanting the sisters to have a moment together. She asks us to join her shortly in a prepared room at the Roost. As the guards carry Ishtola off, the Elder Seed Seer tells us that all that remains to do is pray. She slowly walks back home to Gridania. Raya O. Senna nods at us as she also slowly walks past, and Arun Senna, the little boy, doesn't really acknowledge us. Inside Mother Miyun's inn, Tataru is barely holding it together. She had been so worried, and seeing Ishtola's face again has filled her with emotion.
Ishtola is resting and recovering. While she is still unconscious, signs are positive, and the conjurers say she should wake up soon. These motherfuckers are, like, too lazy to cast Asuna. Like, relatable.
Mm-hmm.
While we wait for that to happen, Tataru has decided to finish her surprise for her long-missing friend. She wants us to grab a few items that she ordered for her finishing touches. One item is in the Leatherworkers Guild, and the other is in the Conjurers Guild. Geva, the Leatherworkers Guildmaster, has no time for us until we mention Tataru's name, after which she tells us she's just finished the piece. It was difficult to get it to Tataru's exact specifications, but thankfully, it's already been paid for since we're not left holding the bag. Before she hands us the item, she asks how someone like Tataru managed to get her hands on a chimerical hide. The own here is huge. It's that you either have to be a very powerful adventurer or wealthy, and she's didn't seem to be either.
Yeah. Tataru continuing to reveal her skills and talents throughout the game is very fun to me, but it is such a drip feed. Inside the Conjurer Cave, Isumi Yan informs us that his piece of the surprise has been sanctified in the sight of the elementals, as Tataru requested. He mentions that it is a particularly powerful staff that even he would struggle to wield. After being her gopher, Tataru doesn't even spill the beans about what the surprise is. She just tells us that the conjurers have released Ishtola into the care of Emitra and that we should go pay her a visit. Tataru grins until her face is about to split open as she sees Ishtola awake and sitting up. She runs towards her in greeting and begins to sob. Ishtola rubs her beret-topped head and turns to us with cloudy white eyes, glad to see us safe.
She senses something has changed about Alphanode. She seems to see the aether around her more keenly than before. Alphanode asks if she is strong enough to talk. She reassures everyone that she is, and Yemitra leaves the room to give the Scion some privacy. Ishtola tells us that she was the one who brought down the tunnel to give us and Minfilia an opportunity to escape. At the last moment, she invoked a teleportation spell to try to get Thancred away, but it went bad and she found herself adrift in the life stream. She asks us worriedly about the other Scions. Alphanode uncrosses his arms and tells her that she is the first one we have been able to find. Huge own on Yurianje, by the way. He apologizes sincerely. It was the Crystal Braves that pursued her, so he feels like his hubris led to the Scion's undoing. Correct. She shakes the apology away and tells him he is not to blame for what happened. Incorrect. Furthermore, if our comrades were all here, they would commend him for keeping the Light of Hope alive. Tataru also leaps in to comfort him, assuring Alphanode that the others are out there and she knows we'll find them. Look, it's okay that you got a lot of innocent people killed and we all had to go into hiding for 6 months because you really thought you just thought about doing better the whole time. It's okay.
He's doing the like slightly too self-aware for his own good toxic man thing of being like, I'm just so fucked up. I just ruined everything. I'm just like, I'm just the worst guy. It's all my fault. And just like laying it on so thick that everyone has to be like, no, it's okay. You're good, actually. When deep inside we're like, yeah, you did fuck up and fuck you for like laying the guilt on so thick that we feel bad for a second.
Yeah.
Alphanode agrees and resolves that we will rebuild the Scions. That sounds more like the Alphanode that Ishtola remembers, and it rouses her enough to stand up. This is when Tataru reveals that she made a new set of clothes for Ishtola after learning how to weave in Ishgard. She asks us and Alphanode to leave the room so Ishtola can get changed. Her new outfit is in the same quasi-military style that all of Tataru's new Scion outfits have been in. She's like, it's like this military coat that has really long, like coat tails that spread out wide to become like a skirt, but she is also wearing a shorter skirt and boots. And so it's like, there's this wide skirt, but also the game is like, don't worry, Ishtola is still going to rock the absolute territory look. You'll still be able to see her thighs. Don't worry, Final Fantasy 14 horn dogs. Apparently, during the change, Tataru filled her in on all that happened in her time away, and Ishtola did not realize that she had spent so long in the life stream and that so much had happened. Wonder if she maybe felt a little bit abandoned. Who knows? Ishtola does not know how to affix an etheric ram to an airship, but she does know someone who might. Matoya, her former master, and also a callback to a Final Fantasy I witch, is a leader in the field of etheric research and one of Charlayan's finest scholars.
Before we start our journey to Matoya, Ishtola wants to tell us a little more about her. Though it was an honor to study under someone who was so renowned and intelligent, she was often willful and difficult, and Ishtola worries that she might not share her knowledge with him. When the Garlayan Empire first showed up in Eorzea 15 years ago, all Charlayan citizens were called back to their home island. Matoya refused and still lives as a hermit on the edge of an abandoned city. It's so weird to me. I forgot that this was supposed to be original Charlayan. How did this never come up in Endwalker? Ever?
Yeah, I know. They totally forgot about the Charlayan outpost. Just totally forgot about it.
Oh, this is supposed to be like their fucking capital.
Right, yes. Yes, yes, they were like,
Alphanode seems to know exactly where this is, a former Charlayan enclave in the Dravanian hinterlands where he and his sister were born. He doesn't have many memories of it since he's 16 years old and the The Exodus happened 15 years ago.
I love the idea of like 1 year old Alpha Node palling around with goblins. I know the goblins like aren't there yet. They come in after the Exodus, but it's still funny to me.
I love that because it's like you can just imagine wind up Alpha Node, basically.
Yeah. Also, it's just a reminder that like Alpha Node is 16 and has been 16 for the last 2 years. We head to Ishgard to prepare for a journey into unknown territory. Once there, Alpha Node tells us that the trek will be grueling. He asks Tataru to stay behind in Ishgard and continue her ear to the ground search for our remaining missing comrades. Our first stop on our trip west is Tailfeather. Alpha Node is taken by nostalgia for our last trip here.
Shut the fuck up, Alpha Node. Don't tell me I'm supposed to be nostalgic about the video game. I just did this 10 hours ago. Fuck you.
You know, he's just reminiscing on our pals, Estinian and Ysael. That's all.
Look, if you're making a game, don't say, wow, remember when you were here 10 hours ago? Doesn't that make you feel something? Don't say that.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. You're right. Ystola is exhausted. A long stay in the life stream really took it out of her, but she assures us her strength is slowly returning. And our strength will continue to slowly return for another couple of weeks, because that is where we are ending this episode.
This sucks so fucking bad. All of this sucks.
The thing that I hate the most, and there are a lot of things to hate, but the thing that I hate the most is that, okay, so it's yet another aetheric barrier being the thing that stops us mm-hmm. and makes us like reconvene and figure out a new way through.
And go on a new series of way too many quests to solve this problem that didn't have to be there.
Yeah, and on top of that, like, the sense of urgency only extends to the point where the Square Enix developers want it to extend. This is supposed to be this, like, breakneck chase so that we can prevent the emperor from getting to not the emperor, the archbishop from getting to Azas Law, and then we are going to spend a lot of hours not doing that and doing some goofy ass shit, and the game is just like, don't worry about it, it's only going to be urgent when we say it's going to be urgent. And that is bad storytelling to me.
We should have some cutscenes of Thordrin trying to get information from these extremely sassy nodes.
Yes, absolutely. That would honestly help.
That's what he's doing. He's mm-hmm. just going around talking to all these shitty floating circle robots.
Yeah.
Oh, it fucking sucks so bad. All of the stuff that sucks about Final Fantasy XIV is in this episode.
Uh-huh.
We got elegant barriers and a lengthy series of quests to get rid of them. We got abandoning the plot for a B plot no one cared about that we could have just handled later. We got going on a all too long road trip instead of advancing the plot. And bonus points, this road trip is in a place you've already been.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the worst place to get around in, even.
Yeah, it was. And then also we've got more tribal racism, which great. That one was just, you know, there's just a sprinkling of that, but it's still there.
Big fuck to this episode. Everything that happens in this episode is maybe makes this the worst content episode since like the Leviathan banquet. And even then you got to hang out with Hori Boulder.
Fuck yeah. And like, it just, I hate that the story of Heaven's Word built to a climax just a little over 50% of the way through Heaven's Word, and then we get this turn where it goes, it, you know, the classic Final Fantasy turn of going from politics to god killing, and then it grinds to a halt. It just, the pacing just stops.
Yeah, the only time this has ever worked for this series is Final Fantasy 12, because the god you kill is also the politician that you've been after.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I'm glad you're as mad at this episode as I am.
I think Heaven's Word sucks really bad, just to let you know where I'm at right now.
Yeah, the replay has really revealed a lot of the flaws to me, and has made it so that it was like, oh, I was just excited that there was like a more traditional Final Fantasy plot happening and that they were able to tell it with characters who were characters. But there is so much wrong here.
How much of that do you think, this change in opinion, do you think is related to A Realm Reborn being significantly better now?
Oh, much. I mean, that a huge part of it. It was, and I also think that I was comparatively warmer when we played A Realm Reborn because I was so surprised at how much smoother it was.
Yeah, like I think A Realm Reborn is mostly fine. Like, it's not bad. It has risen to the level of fine, and now without that like inherent positivity going into this, I'm like, wow, what are we fucking doing here?
Which sucks because I like some of the stuff here. Not in this episode, but I like some of the stuff in Heavensward. I like the whole, the entire basis of the founding of our nation was a lie bit. And I like the characterization of dragons for the most part. And I like what happens in the end game quite a bit, which we can't really talk about right now. But yeah, just huge swaths of this do not work or reveal a lot
or matter,
and they reveal a ton of the just inherent flaws between the disagreement of the play of Final Fantasy 14 and the story of Final Fantasy 14. Just like, well, this expansion does have to be like, you know, 30 to 50 hours, so we just gotta keep going.
But that's the real problem, is that they only have like 5 hours of plot.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, the problem is that the plot all happened in the past. The plot of Heavensward is all stuff that happened in the past, and somebody could just tell you that in a single cutscene, but instead we have to drag it out over like 15 hours of a road trip and then go make up some other stuff to do so you feel like you got your money's worth out of this expansion and it takes you 3 months to beat.
Yeah. I also have no idea what the level 58 and level 60 job quests are gonna be for Heavensward, because all of the jobs that happen in Ishgard for like level 52, 54, 56, they're dealing explicitly with things that are happening in Ishgard and are tied directly into the politics plot. No idea what's gonna happen now that it's in the god killing plot. Like, is it just are these things just gonna end in a wet fart, or is it supposed to be that like, oh well, the level 58 and 60 job quests are like how you stay connected to the politics of Ishgard? We'll see.
Let me tell you right now that as a samurai, I'm going around being a super cop, extrajudicially killing people I deem to be a criminal.
Yay.
One of those is you go on Gegaruju's party boat, and Gegaruju is not the guy you're there to arrest for being a pervert and a criminal. Just to let you know how that goes.
He keeps getting away with it.
Oh, God.
Woof. I mean, the Machinist quest has honestly been pretty sick so far, but I'm nervous about the end of it.
I'm excited about that. Let's give everyone a gun, do a people's revolution. But not really, because it's in a side quest. I might have accidentally deleted the original audio while recording this episode, but hey, peace be with you.
And also with your spirit, I think is what they say now.
Thanks for being a patron. Your continued patronage helps us to make the shows that we all love without it becoming a financial burden or having to put ads in them. In case you didn't know, we have other shows that you might enjoy, such as Being Mr. Boot, Lightning Strikes Thrice, Being Jim Davis, and last but not least, Boku No Stop. You can help us out further by rating and reviewing your favorite show on iTunes and telling a friend about our podcast. Thanks for being a loyal patron. We'll see you next time.